What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's feature is writer, performer, teacher, curriculum innovator, and musician Wayne Harris. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Wayne, talk to us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What was your family like?
Oh, that's a deep subject right off, but here we go. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. Grew up on the north side of St. Louis, which if anybody has ever been there, know that's the black folk side of the city. And really enjoyed my time there. I grew up in a great family unit. So unlike so many of us, I had a very secure beginning. When I look back on it, but I didn't stay in St. Louis very long. I moved out to Los Angeles the day after I graduated from high school. I was gone. And it had to do with the fact that for my entire youth, I was a bugler in a drum and bugle corps. I loved the drum and bugle corps, and we had some great programs in St. Louis. And literally, I followed that passion out to Los Angeles so that I could march in the best drum and bugle corps in the world. And that was kind of my life there for a while, oddly enough. I actually ended up moving to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada to teach an all-girls drum and bugle corps. That's how intense that program was for me. And it was about that time when I was in Canada that I started to take acting classes, some improvisation, and literally it was so that I could include it with the youth groups that I worked with so that they weren't just marching around. I wanted them to be aware of character and role playing and that type of stuff. And literally that work moved me back here to California, working with better groups and kind of doing my thing. But the entire time I was now starting to do some writing, starting to look at my own work instead of, auditioning for other stuff. It kind of went the route of solo performance. And just very lucky to be connected with some amazing teachers and directors over the years through the Marsh. I've worked pretty consistently with David Ford, who is well known in this area in terms of working with solo performance, and Charlie Varon, and just in that community of storytellers, and luckily connected with a producer at the Marsh who has appreciated my work, and so that's just taken off over these since the mid 90s, really. I kind of came to this work late, but have found myself to be in a community that's been very supportive, like I said, of my work, and I've just been, blessed to have that network. So that's kind of brought me to now my sixth full-length solo show.
Talk about that in just a moment. You mentioned that, as a young black kid in St. Louis, that you were in love with drum and bugle corps.
Yeah.
Talk about how you discovered music and what worlds it opened up for you or protected you from.
Interesting. I grew up in the Baptist church. My mother was a alto in an amazing choir, Pleasant Green Missionary Baptist Church. And It was one of those situations where you went twice on Sunday and a couple of times during the week. And my big brother was the church had a drum and bugle corps. And it was an interesting time. There was being of a certain age, being in St. Louis during the 60s, pretty kind of an amazing time in so many ways. At that time, there seemed to be a lot of inner city groups like this, like the Drum and Bugle Corps or the Boys and Girls Club and that. And so we kind of got swept up in that at the church, and we had our own little drum and bugle corps. And I couldn't wait to do what my big brother did. And so it was the rhythm and the uniformity, and I just love marching. And kind of as an aside, and I guess it's not that much of an aside, I had polio when I was very young. And I was lucky. We all know that there were some horrendous situations relative to young children getting polio. I was right on the cusp of the vaccination at the time, and looking back on it, probably I should have been taken care of. But wasn't, and it kind of speaks to the ongoing trials and tribulations Black folks have with the medical establishment. There's no reason why I should have had polio because I was, like I said, I was right at the cusp, 1954, 55, 56. But anyway. So, but I got out of it fairly well. I had one leg that was shorter than the other, so I've always had a slight limp. But I wanted to march. I wanted to march. This opportunity that I had with this Baptist Church Drum and Bugle Corps allowed me to, I'm sure, strengthen my leg more than it would have been. And that beat boy just had me going. And I look back on that time now just as much in love with that young man and that situation as I ever was. But the music there in the old days used to be very militaristic, right? A lot of Sousa and that type of stuff. Well, it started to change. The drum and bugle corps were playing Broadway music. They were playing popular music. And it really was through the Drum and Bugle Corps that I learned about West Side Story, that I learned about Beethoven. And that kind of got me going. And then, kind of couple that with the experience of seeing my mother sing. That really fed me musically. I think I have a very large spectrum of music that I appreciate for various reasons, and it's kind of carried me from that point on.
Thank you for sharing. You wrote a play about your father and his generation of Black men and the railroads. I guess twofold. How did that impact you growing up? And then the second question is, why was this an important element of your lineage to explore?
Interesting. You're talking about Train Stories, is the name of the play. And it was kind of in reaction to the play before, which was Mother's Milk, which was predominantly about my mother. And I thought, I want to write something about my father. I didn't know my father very well. He left when I was fairly early in the about 10. My mother remarried, but my biological father, I did not know that well. And so when I started putting stories together, I didn't have many about him. There was, a lot of it was what I had heard. It was myth and legend, And I kind of took off from there. My father was a dining room porter on the Missouri Pacific Railroad, right? And early on, I just remembering that the nature of his job would mean that he would just be away all the time. But I also remember that his drinking, when he came home, he would still be away. I never had that close of a connection. He always seemed to be away, and he could be mean, is what I remember more than anything else. And I thought, what was behind this man? And I started doing a little research about the Georges, as they were called early on in the railroad industry, the porters, the dining room porters. And I knew that he was, in fact, a dining room porter. And so that was kind of what got me going, is I thought, okay, I want to write a story about someone like my father, and maybe it'll give me an opportunity to kind of, stand in his shoes and get a feel for the environment. And that kind of blossomed into Train Stories, which is about an upright dining car porter who believes in the John Henry story and believes in Marcus Garvey and has these very lofty goals for his race. But he's bouncing up against the reality of Jim Crow, the reality of just living, a black man trying to live in this world. And so it was kind of in reaction to my father, though not necessarily about my father. And there are two other characters. There's a pimp on the railroad, that rides the train. And then there's an old Gandy dancer, if you know who they were. They were the railroad workers that would have the big hammers and, hitting the nails and laying track. And it was a conversation about this one incident, this perspective of this one incident.
All right, let's segue into the play that was just running at the Marsh, Drapetomania. What is that about and what inspired it?
Well, anger. It's not something I deal with much. I'm a pretty positive person. I've always kind of tried to move through the world in a positive way. And shortly after this last election and the blitzkrieg of assault we were seeing coming out of the White House, and I was just finding myself every morning just angry. I found myself unable to write. My conversations were just this kind of diatribe of how screwed up everything is, and I found myself just in people's faces if they weren't, thinking this was the worst thing in the world. And it was just a horrible time for me. And I needed to do something with that energy. And I realized right away that I couldn't keep going forward like this. And so I started taking a look at my journey in terms of activism. I'd sit there on my couch. I call it being a couch ally. I'd sit there on my couch and root things on, and yeah, and like memes and post zingers and yeah, and it's what I've done all my life, is this superficial participation in social justice issues. And I wanted to take a look at my journey, and I thought in doing so, it would allow others to take a look at what they're doing. Well, during COVID, like many of us, I bought a copy of the 1619 Project, and I was reading, and there was information in there about this Dr. Samuel A. Cartwright, who in 1851 came up with this idea that enslaved Africans who were running away from slavery, from the plantations, he figured that they were suffering from a mental illness. And he wrote quite a bit of material around this idea that since slavery was an obvious improvement in the lives of enslaved Africans, any of them that were running away, had to be suffering from a mental illness. And I saw the connection with that pseudoscience of 1851 and the pseudoscience that we're dealing with today. I saw the connection of in 2012, I was asked to go to Palestine by the U.S. State Department to perform and do storytelling workshops with librarians and such. And it was, I can't tell you how revealing that time was for me. And being able to see that level of oppression, and now so clearly the connection between my own journey as a black man living in America and the level of oppression that we suffer from here, and really being able to see it on a more universal level. I had no idea what Palestine was like. I had no idea about the walls and the inability of Palestinians to be able to move freely. I just didn't know. And it was during that trip that another consciousness started to rise, but I didn't follow through. During the civil rights movement, I thought Panthers were cool. They looked tight, but I never joined. I never went to rallies, I speak in the play about during the 80s when crack devastating black communities in the US. I was living in Canada at the time, and kind of being a black novelty, as opposed to a black threat, and kind of working in that world, right? And not witnessing and connected to that devastating era that still, as has large ramifications. So the piece is about sharing my experience in terms of not doing the things that I maybe could have done over the years. And I actually recreated my desk from home on stage, and it's how I would sit at home listening to podcasts or, and starting to write this piece and starting to put these pieces together that my life experiences have had. And hopefully motivating my own self to do more, to not just be a couch ally. And that's why half of these performances have been in collaboration with groups like Indivisible, with the Movement Voters PAC, with the Musicians Collective, where the performances are benefiting those groups. It's as a storyteller, it's what I think I can do right now as a tangible thing that's not just sitting on the couch, being this kind of ally of events. So,
The first thing I want to do is thank you for your vulnerability and honesty. I'm in addition to being an artist, I'm an I don't know what you know about me, but I'm an organizer and an activist, and I've been in these streets for a really long time. And there's a lot of people that want to defend their couch allyship is actual activism and organizing. And one of the things that I've been saying when I talk is like, this is not the time for QT. Like, the time for QT activism is over, right? And so, A, I want to commend your honesty and your vulnerability, right? The truth telling, that is what performance is for. And B, not that you need this from me, but I feel inclined to say to you, right? We get there when we get there. And perhaps your journey to being able to tell this story, you couldn't tell the story if you had joined the Panthers in the 70s. And I actually, and we can talk about it offline. I'd like to invite you. So I'm with the Lower Bottom Players in Oakland, and our audiences are Black folk. And I think more Black folks need to hear Black folks being honest and vulnerable about it taking a minute for them to find their place inside a liberatory struggle. I think that's a really powerful message, my brother. And I think more Black folks, especially right now, need to hear it. So I haven't even seen the piece, and I want to thank you for writing it. And I hope that, as art is for most of us, that there was some healing that happened for you in the writing and performing of the piece.
Absolutely. It brought me out of that. Well, the anger is still there. We're dealing with every morning, and it's just piling up, and it's not stopping. But being able to focus that energy in a way that, as an artist, was fulfilling. But I got to tell you, these performances, have just been wonderful. There's a moment in the play where I talk about the first time I'm on stage in the West Bank. I'm in Ramallah, and I'm at a high school, and you don't know what to expect. I had no idea what to expect, and I go on stage, and the story that I'm telling them is about Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And that's the piece. And during the piece, I talk about the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, the boycott, and how the boycott had been going on for weeks, and it was no longer front page news. It was, it wasn't having the reporting the same. So King and the leaders were trying to come up with ideas to get press back. And so on that one day, the first 20 protesters who came out of the church were younger than they had been. Up until this time, it had been adults and college students. But on this night, these groups of 20 children coming out of this church, and they were singing, "We Shall Overcome." And there's lots of famous pictures that you see the kids, as young as 6 years old, being put on buses and taken to jail. And I talked about the fact that those parents of those kids were singing, "We Shall Overcome." And I start to sing, "We Shall Overcome," in this stage in Ramallah on the West Bank. And these kids, they start to sit up and they start to sing the song with me. They know this song. And usually I only do like a verse, right? Because I'm telling a story. But I get goosebumps now when I think about those kids in Palestine knowing that song, singing that song, and that feeling that we all get when we bring that old Negro spiritual back up and sing that together. It was just a beautiful thing. And so it's those type of situations that I'm looking at and saying, you've been given these experiences. So as a storyteller, that's what I want to try to share is that.
It's a very apropos story to end our conversation on. We talk a lot here about the inextricable link between Black and Palestinian liberation. So my listeners will resonate deeply. Wayne Harris, thank you so much for joining us today. Deeply appreciate you.
This has been great.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance and Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.